Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. By my last count, Leonard Lerman has composed 228 works that include 11 operas, 7 musicals, and more than 400 vocal works. Since 1973, he has worked as conductor, coach, pianist, composer, and/or translator for the Metropolitan Opera, Bel Canto Opera, After Dinner Opera Company, Aviva Players, the Metropolitan Philharmonic Chorus, the Jewish Music Theater of Berlin, the Jewish People's Philharmonic Chorus, the Workman's Circle Chorus, the Oceanside Chorale, the Blaue Jungs Hanseaten Dirn German Chorus of East Meadow, and the Bronx Opera. He's also the author and editor of a number of books, and he joins us now to talk about his distinguished career along with his wife and sometimes collaborator, soprano Helene Williams. And later we will be joined also by Thomas Smith. Hello, all.
Hi, Len.
Hello, Leonard. Thank you.
And Leonard, I forgot to mention that you were also a radio broadcaster in the past. Didn't you once have a radio show on BAI from 1989, 1991?
That's right. I was chief producer at the Harvard radio station back in 68 to 70. And in BAI, I produced morning music 3 times in 1979. Then in 1989, Stuart Hutchinson invited me on the show to do an interview about the Rosenberg Cantata that I'd written. He interviewed Michael Mirapol and myself, and he said, "You do this very well. You should have your own show." And they gave me my own show. It was called Music of All the Americas from 1989 to 1991. And
you a DJ?
Well, I'm an announcer and a producer.
Somebody else was actually queuing up the records.
Well, the first time I was on BAI in 87, Cynthia Bell had a show. And in fact, Helene and I have a website where we list 625 performances that we've done in public. And the first one was actually a taped performance that was done on that show in March of 1987. And Cynthia Bell didn't show up at the beginning of the show. So I got to interview Judith Shatton Allen until she showed up. I was the temporary host at that time. So, yeah, I've done that.
A typical BAI story. Was it one of your operas broadcast on BAI on December 25th, 1989? Hannah, anti-war feminist Hanukkah opera?
Correct. That was my fourth opera. The first 3 and parts of Hannah were broadcast during those morning music programs in 79. Completed the opera in 1980. And it was an anti-war feminist Hanukkah opera that was broadcast on Christmas Day in 1989, the day that George Bush the Elder invaded Panama. So it was apropos.
So it's an anti-war opera that was broadcast on Christmas Day, the day of an invasion.
That's right.
Well, that's
and the
sounds like today. The kind of thing could happen right now.
Well, it was the American premiere occurred finally in 2014 at Hebrew Union College, where I was teaching the first course in Jewish opera. But the broadcast was of the recording that we made in Heidelberg or Mannheim Seckenheim. It was an American military theater that sponsored this anti-war opera. And we did that, and I think we have a clip from that, the very beginning of the opera, right?
Were there many Jewish operas before the 20th century? The only person I could think of is Halevi writing the librettist for Bizet.
Well, Halevi's La Juive is a masterpiece.
Yeah.
And he wrote a number of other operas, too, La Juive Errante, and Noé was an unfinished opera that Bizet completed, actually, for his father-in-law, Halevi. And Fomental Halevi is probably the first great Jewish opera composer, but there were many others. Anton Rubinstein, for example, wrote an opera about the Maccabees. It's the only other opera I know about the Maccabees besides my opera, Hannah. But it's a fascinating opera written in Russian and in German, and I've taken that as a cue now because my newest opera is written in English and in German about Rosa Luxemburg.
So is that your 12th?
Yes.
Isn't Hannah difficult to perform? You have a number of cantors, male and females, who sing major roles.
Well, it was unique in 2014 that we were able to cast just about every role in the opera with a cantor. And they did it as a kind of an alumni event at Hebrew Union College. It was really spectacular.
Well, there have been many cantors who've gone into classical music. The Metropolitan Opera had
Richard Tucker.
And Jan Pierce as well.
And Robert Merrill.
So, yeah, so do they have those kinds of voices?
They used to. The tragedy is that today they don't even teach piano or organ as a major. You have to learn guitar to be a cantor. And
really?
And even though I prepared 12 lectures for the course that I was teaching, I only got to give two of them before the students decided that the opera was not going to help them in their cantorial careers. I ended up giving five of the lectures sponsored by Joel Mandelbaum and the Maldib Foundation at the community church where I conduct the chorus for the High Holidays every year for the Metropolitan Synagogue in, since 2014.
You work at both synagogues and Christian churches, a Presbyterian church as well. So you're non-denominational?
I was a Presbyterian church for 11 years, but I'm actually the Lutheran church right now. And I'm also artist in residence at an Anglican church, Trinity Episcopal Church in Roslyn.
But liturgical music is not the same in different churches, although Jewish liturgical music in the Ashkenazic tradition almost sounds at times like Russian opera.
Yes, more like Mendelssohn, actually. I mean, Moses Mendelssohn was the father of Reform Judaism, and his grandson, Felix Mendelssohn, wrote largely Christian music, but Elijah could be considered Jewish. And the Nazis didn't care. They banned Mendelssohn just before his ancestry. There's a lot of German music. Well, Ein Kelohenu, which is sung at the end of many, many services, is actually a Prussian march. And Zung nit Kainmal, the song that's sung during Holocaust remembrance, the song of the Warsaw Ghetto, is actually a Cossack march. I mean, the Jews borrowed from the best music that they could find wherever they were.
You've studied with an impressive list of teachers that include Lenore Anhalt, Ellie Siegmeister, the Quinary Quartet. I'm quoting from Wikipedia, and I've left a whole bunch out. Earl Kim, Nadja Boulanger, Leon Kirchner, Robert Palmer, Herbert Deutsch, and they also mention Donald Erb, who is the co-inventor of the Moog synthesizer.
No, Herbert Deutsch was the co-inventor.
Oh, Herbert Deutsch was...
Donald Erb was a visiting professor at Indiana University the one year that I was there. We were just talking with Greg Ursay, and we were there at the same time. And I studied with Donald Erb and John Eaton at Indiana for a year. But Ellie Siegmeister was my major teacher and mentor, and along with his teacher, Nadja Boulanger.
Yeah, so those two names really stand out. Mm-hmm. Nadja Boulanger, probably the most celebrated teacher, music teacher of
in
the
history.
20th century, with an incredible group of students. How old were you when you went there, and what were the circumstances?
Well, I wasn't 6 or 7 or 10 like some of my colleagues, but I was 11 years old when I went to Ellie Siegmeister, and he said at first that he wouldn't take anyone that young.
But you were conveniently on Long Island, and he was as
that's
well.
That's right. Roslyn and Great Neck, and my father was practicing in Great Neck as a psychiatrist. He's still my father's listening. I hope he's 95, and his aides are helping him listen to this broadcast right now. And he and my mother took me to Ellie Siegmeister when I was 11, and he said, I don't take students that young, and I looked at all his compositions. He had been conducted by Stokowski and Toscanini and Metropolis, and he had pictures, he had a picture of himself with Leonard Bernstein and Mark Blitzstein and Aaron Copland organizing the American Soviet Music Society, and I said, how long would it take to play all of your music? He said, about a week. I said, well, it'll only take 45 minutes to play what I've written, so would you like to hear it? So I played it for him, and then he said, take a walk, and when I came back, he said, I'll take him. He said to my parents. So I worked with
him
7 years and 3 summers, and I became his longest student. He said on his deathbed, I don't want to call you my disciple because I don't believe in doctrine, but you're my continuator. And in fact, I wrote the biobibliography of Siegmeister, and my own autobiography is going to be called The Continuator. As far as Nadja Boulanger is concerned.
You are the co-founder of the Ellie Siegmeister Society.
Yes, with my wife, Helene Williams. Mm-hmm. We founded it on his 90th birthday and kept it going till his centennial when we did a CD. And Ellie's music was very widely performed. On his 80th birthday, we first performed the Manhattan premiere of his cantata, I Have a Dream, inspired by Dr. King's speech. I had been to the March on Washington with my father. Ellie hadn't, but I told him about it, and he was commissioned by a temple in Long Beach and wrote one of the great choral works of the 20th century, I Have a Dream, which I had the honor of performing in 1989 at its Manhattan premiere. That year, there were 60 performances of Ellie's music. 20 years later, for his centennial, there were 30. We did most of them. This coming January 15th is the 110th birthday of Ellie Siegmeister. We will be doing a program of his music at the community church on that day and on the following Sunday. And in fact, Tom Smith will be singing his Strange Funeral in Braddock, and we'll be doing the I Have a Dream finale.
And there's a lot of politics in all of this work. You mentioned your new opera, Love Letter from Rosa Luxemburg. Mark Blitzstein has played an important role in your career. He was called to testify before the House Un-American Activities Committee, but
he never testified, though, except in he testified in an executive session, which was never supposed to be leaked, and then it was leaked by a reporter named Sokolsky to try to disparage the Metropolitan Opera that had commissioned his Sacco and Vanzetti, which was his magnum opus that I spent 25 years completing.
You completed two of his operas.
Yes,
in his style.
Well, Idiots First was the opera that Leonard Bernstein said he was going to finish and then gave up for emotional reasons. And Ellie Siegmeister and David Diamond were asked to try to complete it. And Siegmeister recommended me, and then I did it with their blessing and that of Bernstein and Malamud. That took about 3 years. I also analyzed it with Nadia Boulanger because she had been his teacher also. I was very fond of him.
And she'd been Leonard Bernstein's teacher.
A colleague. They moved in. He visited her on her deathbed, he didn't actually study with her, but he studied with Copland, and Copland was her prize pupil. To get back to Blitzstein, that after I completed that opera of his, and it won the Most Important Render of the Season Award, Leighton Kertner of the Village Voice gave it in 1978. It finally had its orchestral premiere in 1992 with the Center for Contemporary Opera. And I spent 25 years completing Blitzstein's major work, which he called his magnum opus, the opera Sacco and Vanzetti. And that had its premiere with the White Barn Theater in 2001, but it is still awaiting its orchestral premiere.
I've been told that your book on Mark Blitzstein is the longest about any American composer, even longer than anything written about Charles Ives or Aaron Copland?
Well, it's a bibliography. It's 645 pages. And when it came out in 2005, I think it was the longest. I'm not sure it is anymore. There's another book about Blitzstein by Howard Pollack, which is also worth looking at, definitely.
When you began composing, the dominant musical approaches were serialism and minimalism. Some composers chose to incorporate jazz and folk music influences in their work. What about you?
Minimalism came much later. But serialism was something that Nadia Boulanger fought against, and yet her colleague Igor Stravinsky and her protege Aaron Copland found their way to serialism, their own method of serialism, which she eventually accepted. And I wrote 12-tone music when I was studying with her. She sort of looked askew at it, but she accepted it. I'll tell you a good story about Siegmeister, though. He never accepted 12-tone music. And one of my first pieces that I wrote for him back in 64 had a 12-tone row. Actually, every phrase was a different 12-tone row. It wasn't the orthodox 12-tone system. But he looked at it and he said, 12-tone, huh? And years later, when he and I were playing tennis with my father and his partner, we were playing doubles, and he and I were at the net, and I hit the ball by him, and he said, "Help! I'm being beaten by a 12-toner!"
The worst thing you could have been. Now, does it depend on whether you're writing for an orchestra or a singer, or whether it's an opera or a musical?
Does what depend?
What style, whether you're doing something, including something 12-tone. I want to bring Helene in here. Are his vocal works, many of which were written for you, are they difficult to perform?
Not to perform, but to learn. Some of them are. When he keeps a regular meter, 3/4, 4/4, 6/8 or something, I find it wonderfully charming.
Well, 6/8 is an elongated waltz,
yes,
actually.
Yes,
well,
that's right. But then when it gets at 5, I can take because it's da-da-da-da-da-da. But 7 drives me nuts. I will say, and some of his pieces are so challenging that I perform them, perform the premiere, and then say, fine, try somebody else on this next time. But the Rosa Luxemburg Opera is marvelous. It's challenging for me to a point, but it's also very rewarding because there's a lot of wonderful music in it.
What role do you play?
Rosa.
Oh, you're the star.
I am the star.
It's a monodrama.
A great revolutionary who died young.
Yes, 49.
Yes.
Well, it's a monodrama that can be performed like Schoenberg's of Arton by just one singer. But optimally, one would have a flutist as well as a piano, a chorus, and five different men singing the men in her life. And we have that for these performances that we're doing in January. It's going to be performed in Hamburg in February with just one singer, and then again in October in Lüneburg with one singer and a flute and piano. But the way that Helene is doing it, well, Tom is actually going to be singing one very small role, but the important role, the role of Karl Liebknecht, the socialist who stood up against the war and was killed with Rosa on January 15th, 1919. This is the centennial. This opera came about because Joel Mandelbaum invited us to a dinner with Susan Fox, his librettist for his operas, and she said, what about an opera about Rosa Luxemburg? I said, that's a great idea. Let's do it. Wait, oh my God, January 15th is coming up. We have to do it immediately. And she said, well, I can't. I have other projects. But I found other collaborators that, inspired by her in Berlin and in Wisconsin and New York and New Jersey.
I'm speaking with Leonard Lerman, a composer, and composer, conductor, and pretty much everything else in music, and with soprano Helene Williams, who performs much of his work. And in a little while, Helene, you'll be singing one of the pieces a cappella?
Yeah, one of his earlier pieces that we collaborated on through the years. When did we premiere that?
Well, this is a setting of a poem by Abel Mirapol,
the man who wrote Strange Fruit.
And The House I Live In with Earl Robinson. And this opera, Darlin' Corey, which was premiered at Hofstra. It was Abel Mirapol. He wrote under the pen name Lewis Allen. Mm-hmm. Abel Mirapol's and Elie Sigmeister's first opera. And then Abel and his wife Anne adopted the Rosenberg sons and were harassed by the FBI. And a number of people, including Sigmeister, cut them off out of fear. And it wasn't until many years later that they tried to get back together again. Abel already had Alzheimer's. It was impossible. So when Abel died, I approached his sons. I said, I have a recording of Darlin' Corey, which I played on WHRB, and would you like to hear it? They invited me up to hear it. It was a memorial to Abel Mirapol. They presented us with a book of his poetry, and in that book was this wonderful poem, Conscience, which I set to music, and it was one of the first I met Helene a month later, and it was one of the first of over 150 pieces that I have written for Helene.
Now, you collaborate with Leonard on these pieces. What is that collaboration like?
Well,
are you writing some of the music as well?
No, what happens is that he'll come up with a libretto. I will look at the libretto and I'll say, I've got too many S's there, I can't sing. and he'll set it and I'll say, I can't sing that vowel up there, can we change the word? He'll say, no, I need that melody. So I said, all right, well, so this is our collaboration. Also, it does, once in a while, I do help him with a word or with a formal structure type of thing, saying, for example, there was one piece that you wrote that I said, well, why don't you have him do some whistling as an interlude? Remember that piece?
Yeah, we got a lot of whistling in the opera, whistling and humming, actually.
But in this opera. There was the booby trap.
Oh, that's a different show.
I'm not sure I could whistle in a 12-tone row.
He wrote a 12-tone Christmas carol once on a dare.
That's right.
It's
there is no 12-tone music in this particular opera, but one of my most recent works is 12-tone. I had an experience similar to what I think you had, which was that I belonged to an organization that I really promoted and doubled the membership and tripled the number of concerts and did the most successful concert they'd ever had in their history. And then I was told that I was being expelled without any opportunity to defend myself, without any grounds, and I appealed to no avail. And I was so crestfallen that I set to music Emily Dickinson's Why Do They Shut Me Out of Heaven?
I
sing
wish
too
I'd thought
loud.
Of that.
Well, I did, in the middle of the night, coming back from a trip to Europe, having learned the news that all my appeals were in vain. And that piece, I set it as a 12-tone roll, and I sent it to a number of composers, and Joel Mandelbaum responded by writing a late 19th-century style Brahmsian Wolfian accompaniment for the 12-tone row, and it's going to be premiered at our concerts at Community Church January 15th and January 20th.
You have a lot of things coming up. You said some of them in Europe, but also in the New York area?
January 13th is the premiere of the opera and of Mark Blitzstein's Children's Cantata, which I resurrected from 1934. It was never performed. And the Elie Singmeister piece that we talked about. That's going to be at the Puffin Cultural Forum, Teaneck, New Jersey, on the 13th of January at 4 o'clock. And then that program, most of it, will be repeated. All of it will be repeated with some additions, actually. At January 15th and 20th at the Community Church, and January 26th, that's a Saturday afternoon, at Long Beach Library.
Now, you sent us a list of things that you would love to hear on today's show. What's the first piece?
Well, Hannah is the opera that we were talking about that was broadcast, the last opera of mine broadcast on BAI.
So it will be repeating, it'll be coming back to BAI in a sense?
In a sense. We'll just hear like the first minute of it. Oh. It's a very calm prologue, which is then disrupted as the sanctuary is invaded by Seleucid soldiers that have an orgy and rape, which sets the scene for the rest of the opera.
Now, this is the story of the Maccabees that we don't normally hear.
That's right. This is the story of Hannah.
This is what leads up to the Hanukkah story.
Hannah, the daughter of Mattathias, tore off all her clothes at her wedding night to protest having to sleep with the local overlord, according to the law of the first night, sort of the marriage of Figaro 2,000 years earlier. And at first they were about to kill her, and then she pleaded.
The ruler had the right, or took the right, to sleep with the virgin bride before she got married.
On the night of her wedding.
And she did not. And she wanted to do that.
And she objected to this, and she appealed to her brothers in the name of shame, and they responded by going to the hegemon and demanding justice. And when he refused to give that to them, they killed him. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning of the Maccabean revolt. And Rashi has
Rashi is a commentator on the Talmud. On all of
and
the
Midrashim, yeah, he has a comment. He says Hanukkah is la fête des femmes. Hanukkah is a holiday for women, and why? Because women were involved in the miracle. How were women involved in the miracle? This story explains that.
And that's something we don't hear much anymore.
No, it's in the mimicry.
Your opera deals with it. That's right. So you've called it a feminist anti-war opera.
Hanukkah opera, right? So you want to hear the beginning of it?
Of course,
okay.
Please. So that was just a brief excerpt from the opening of the opera, and then those people who are laughing are soldiers?
Yeah, there's a Seleucid soldiers desecrating the temple, and it was the desecration of the temple, of course, that outraged the Maccabees so much. And Hanukkah means consecration, reconsecration.
More than the rape, you think?
Yeah, the temple was seen as the rape of the temple, and a woman was raped at the same time, and the fact that women were treated part as property is part of the message of the opera.
Interestingly, it was performed by the 7th Army Soldiers Corps.
That's right, or members of the 7th Army Soldiers Corps.
The 7th Army doing an anti-war opera.
Right.
Well, that must have gone over well, but it was in Germany, so I guess
It was an American group of singers from all over the community. We had soldiers, and we had their wives, and we had dependents, and it was really quite an experience.
As I mentioned earlier, a lot of your other works are performed a lot, but this one hasn't been all that much. Is it because it's difficult, or?
Well, Hannah's a big grand opera. I mean, it's a three-act opera. We usually do it cutting part of one scene and shortening the second and third act so that they come together. The way Wozzeck is sometimes performed in just two acts rather than three. But it's a big major enterprise. It took a long time to put it together. Excerpts from it have been performed a great deal. The year that we did Hannah at the Hebrew Union College, we had eight concerts, we call them Jewish Opera Today, performed in synagogues and community centers all over the New York area, New Jersey, in preparation for that opera, and we did excerpts from the opera.
And you're about to do a full production soon?
Well, the new opera is much smaller than Hannah. It's much more portable. It can be done with just one singer and a piano, although we will also have flute and five men.
That's a Rosa Luxemburg love letter from Rosa Luxemburg,
yes.
Now, Hannah, you're going to be performing live for us in the studio?
You mean Helene.
Helene, I'm sorry.
No, yes. Yes.
Confusing you with the character.
We were talking about Abel Mirabal before and the song Conscience, which I actually took and used the music of again in the Rosa Luxemburg opera, because she talks about how I want to burden the conscience
of the affluent.
What's the whole quote?
I want to burden the conscience of the affluent to... Right. I have not committed this to memory yet.
Here it is. I want to burden the conscience of the affluent with all the suffering and the hidden bitter tears of the oppressed. I want to affect people like a clap of thunder, to inflame their minds with the breadth of my vision, the strength of my conviction, and the power of my expression. And I have Rosa singing that while the chorus is humming this song, Conscience, in the background.
And Conscience is the first of 146 pieces, I gather, that you've written for Helene.
Well, it's a third, actually.
Uh-huh. Yeah, actually, when we were just courting, I had to go to Florida, and Leonard was home, and so I wrote a poem, and he set the poem to music. I'm so excited.
That was the first one.
And we've never performed that. But
yes, we did. We had at my 40th birthday.
Was that really?
Yes.
Okay, fine.
We performed for my 40th birthday concert at Temple Sinai in Roslyn.
Oh, of course.
And the second piece that I wrote for you was actually the reason that Tom Smith is here, because he heard her sing it on the radio in WBAI in 2003. That was the setting of a poem by John Reed.
Now, this is why you can never trust the Internet, because the Internet says this is the first thing.
It was one of the first.
Anyway.
Want an excerpt?
Yes, please.
Sure. Conscience is not a leaf in the wind to be shaken at a gust, but a deep root holding fast, because it must.
And that's that. And he bases the rest of it, the canon, on that melody.
That is Helene Williams performing Conscience, the setting of a poem by Abel Mirabal, to Leonard Lerman wrote in December 1986.
Well, I found the poem in December of 86, and I actually set it to music in May of 87.
Now, that demands a lot of range.
Yeah. In fact, this was assigned to a mezzo-soprano soloist. But, you know, I have a lot of range.
Sure, I'm talking with Leonard Lerman, who is, I think, described in one of the things that I read, is the most prolific composer on Long Island.
Living on Long Island. My teacher, Eli Siegmeister, was even more prolific than I. He had nine symphonies and 20 stage works and many orchestral pieces and over 100 songs. I've got written actually more songs than he has, and more operas, but not as many orchestral
works. Well, you're married
works.
To a singer.
That's right. But he really was my mentor, and
Would people recognize, would they think of your work as an extension of his, or is your style totally your own?
I think it's his own. Mm-hmm. Ellie popped around a little bit, not as much as Stravinsky did from one style to another, but Ellie had his folk style, and then he gave that up and decided to write more au courant classical style. But Leonard does have his own style, and when I pick up a piece of music that's new, and my sight reading through the years has deteriorated, I can just tell what he's written because it's the intervals they're him, you know. It's the way he hears melody relating to human speech, and that's one of the things I like about what he writes.
So human speech is an important factor.
Very, very important. And I got that from Siegmeister, who got it from Wallingford Rieger. The idea of that prosody is so important. This is something that Stravinsky discarded when he was writing in a language that wasn't his own. His Russian settings are true to the Gagic accents of the language, but he didn't care when he was writing in English. We talked to Robert Kraft about that. I mean, the Rake's Progress is some of the most beautiful music and some of the worst set texts in the world. But Siegmeister was really tough about that. And I mean, I remember setting a poem of Blake, and he made me rewrite it 9 times before he was satisfied with it. And when I write for Helene. You were asking about how we collaborate. Frequently, I will have her read something, and if she makes a mistake, frequently I will say, well, maybe that's better. Not all the time, but sometimes she'll do something a little differently. I said, yeah, that's actually a better alternative. Let's do it that way.
We actually had a small battle royal last night when we were going through some music about one of these Gagic accents, and he said, oh, no, do it this way, do it this way. I said, but I can't. I said, well, don't take a breath there. And well, we finally worked it out, but it took a good 10 minutes of concentrated work.
So you've also translated
yes.
The lyrics from various foreign languages. Can you improve them for the singer while you're doing that?
Well, the translations that I've written have been almost all singing translations. I started out...
Well, you said some of them are a little rough, like some of the Stravinsky's.
No, I wouldn't...
He doesn't say that. No, I did.
but I translated Yevtushenko, Khachat li Ruskiye vayny, Do the Russians Want War? There was a song that he wrote that was very popular in the Soviet Union, and it was published in an English translation by the Columbia University Forum by Mario Pei. But I had a record of it, and the translation didn't go with the music. So I said, I'm going to write one that goes with the music. And my high school newspaper published it, and later I gave it to Yevtushenko so that it went with the music. And then my mother and I worked on two of the great Russian operas, The Life of the Tsar, which the Bel Canto opera did in its first English language performance in 79, and Dargomyshki's Rusalka, which hasn't been done in this country since Shalyapin did it in 22, and we did the premiere of it in English in memory of my mother. She died in January of 2015, and in November of 2015, Queen's College hosted us in the first performance of Rusalka in English. Helene was my Rusalka.
His mother was a native Russian speaker. That's and right. Did and was extremely influenced by well, not influenced. She knew English literature as well. She came over here when she was 12.
And she was the interpreter for Solomon Michoels, probably the greatest Yiddish actor who ever lived, who was the head of the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee, raised millions of dollars in this country. She interpreted for him in Boston. We just got back from Boston last month, where we did 2 concerts in the memory of her and him. They died on the same day, January 13, 67 years apart. When we were in Moscow and Belarus performing, and I mentioned Michoels, and that my mother had been his Perevochitsa, his interpreter, immediately the people started treating us like royalty. I mean, he's an incredible figure in the history of Russian Jewry.
Now, the third piece we're going to hear is a solo piano composition by Mark Blitzner.
Yes. This was written, it was called Innocent Psalm for the Bernstein Baby. It was written for Jamie Bernstein, whom I understand you've met and interviewed. Mm-hmm. It was written before she was even named, so it's not doesn't have her name on it. It just says for the Bernstein baby, and I did the first performance of it in Manhattan at a meeting of the National Committee to Reopen the Rosenberg Case, honoring the birthday, the birth of the first great-grandchild of Judith and Ethel Rosenberg, which was appropriate because Mark Blitstein was thinking of the Rosenbergs while writing Sacco and Vanzetti. His sister told me that. And then I recorded it at Queens College in 2005. It was the first recording. There have been other recordings since then in conjunction with the Bernstein Centennial. But my recording is about to come out. February 1st will be the launch date. We're going to London for it. And this one-minute piece is called Innocent Psalm for the Bernstein Baby.
And that's you playing Leonard Lee?
Yes. And I was just saying that if you listen carefully, there's a formula, kind of a trope in there, that he uses a lot, which Bernstein told his amanuensis Jack Gottlieb, who wrote it up in a thesis that I read, that this particular formula, this particular series of notes, which was in Blitstein's lullaby in No for an Answer, inspired Bernstein. And you can hear it in so much Bernstein. Tonight, e-da-da, for example. And there are many, many other places.
Blitstein is probably remembered best for some of the things like Cradle of Rock and things
Regina,
like that. And then his relations.
And Tripoli Opera.
The things they did with Brecht.
Bert Brecht inspired.
He's putting Brecht to
Bert
to music.
Brecht inspired Cradle of Rock. Mm-hmm. And what's fascinating about that is that, you see, Blitstein played him. His wife, Eva Goldbeck, was a translator of Brecht, and they met at a party at their house, at the Blitstein's house in the village. And Blitstein played Brecht a scene about a prostitute. And Brecht said, "Why not a whole show where you show that everybody under capitalism sells out like this prostitute?" And in fact, he was writing his own piece about that called The Roundheads and the Pointed Heads. He had a character named Nana. Nana's Lead is a very famous excerpt from that. And that piece was never produced satisfactorily in Brecht's own time. But I did the American premiere at Cornell in 73, and we're about to revive that on these concerts we're doing in January. The full score that Hans Eisler wrote for The Roundheads and the Pointed Heads. And Helena's singing Nana, as she did back in 1998 for the Blitstein,
right.
for the Eisler Centennial.
And it's on the same program as the Rosa Luxemburg opera.
That's right. And she's also going to sing the Nickel Under the Foot from the Cradle of Rock in one of those four concerts.
It's interesting. So many of these things have a political side to them. A lot of music is written without any politics in mind. But are you attracted to the composers who were political?
What did Rosa Luxemburg say about?
I mean, Bernstein
to
was.
Be a,
Blitstein was.
To be
apolitical is
to be political without knowing it. Yeah,
I think we should put that on the wall.
Yes, and Rosa Luxemburg, absolutely. Yeah, no, if you don't take a stand with what's happening, you're simply abetting the status quo, and God forbid.
But music itself, unless you're writing some stirring march, is apolitical, isn't it?
My doctoral thesis was about Leonard Bernstein's Serenade after Plato's Symposium, and I demonstrated by comparing passages from that purely instrumental work to similar passages in other works that he had written, which had words, that even in this purely instrumental work, he had specific program content in mind. And Candide is nothing if not political. It's an anti-McCarthyist, or it was with the way Hellman wrote it. West Side Story is a critique of society. I mean, everything that Bernstein wrote was a critique of society. We discovered a piece of his called The Victory Jive that he wrote for Russian War Relief that we performed a number of times. And we know that Bernstein himself was in Boston to perform it in 1942. How do we know that he performed it? Because his FBI file says so. And when we performed it, we mentioned that, and somebody said, why did Bernstein have an FBI file? And my answer was, because he believed in fighting for truth and justice. And some people didn't like that.
J. Edgar Hoover surely did.
Exactly.
What's our next week?
Jamie, by the way, sent me an email after I said that. She said, loved the FBI explanation. So what would you like to hear next? We have another piece that was used has been used in the Rosa Luxemburg opera. It's a setting of a German poem, which I translated into English, a love song by Masha Kaleko, mm-hmm. who was a German-Jewish writer exiled from Nazi Germany. And her poem about unrequited love is really not just about a lover, but about a country.
And then we want to get Thomas into the conversation for just a little bit.
Sure.
We're running out of time. Okay. But let's listen to this.
Track 5 on More Songs of Love.
Leonard Lerman on piano and Helene yes. Williams on the singer.
Yes, it's called Love Song or Liebeslied, poem by Masha Kaleko. And I used the music and some of the words as well in a love letter for Rosa Luxemburg written for Helene. The beginning of the song is almost identical to the beginning of one of Rosa's letters. Wenn du mich nicht mehr liebst, wenn du mich einmal nicht mehr liebst, if you don't love me, if you decide you don't love me anymore. And she was writing this to a young lover, and it just seemed so appropriate and poignant, and it's one of our favorite parts of the opera. The opera is based on the German letters of Rosa Luxemburg, which I was sent by the Rosa Luxemburg Stiftung in Berlin after first having read all of them in English in these wonderful volumes, The Letters of Rosa Luxemburg and Red Rosa, a graphic biography by Kate Evans that my dear friend and colleague Tom Smith loaned me.
But wait, it'll be performed in German in Germany?
In German and Germany.
Hi, Tom Smith.
Hi, Leonard. How are you?
Glad we don't have much time, but I wanted to sneak you in here. You are the reason we're doing this in the first place. Thank you so much for introducing us. We're making the contact for Leonard.
Oh, you're welcome. It's an honor to be here.
And you also sing?
Yes, I'm a tenor.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing Carl Liebknecht, the four words so far. I hope there's a bigger part for me, better versions of the opera. And I'm singing a setting of a poem that was one of Rose's favorites by
Thomas Heywood.
Thomas Heywood.
1608, yeah. Mm-hmm. And he's also singing Strange Funeral in Braddock, which was Elie Siegmeister's first published composition. And he's...
It's about a man who drowned in concrete because of an industrial accident where the bosses were not very interested in safety.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry,
Braddock, Pennsylvania. Yeah.
I'm thinking about Pietro di Donato's Christ in Concrete. His father, Geremio, died in concrete. This guy died in steel.
Yeah, it's a very, very dynamic piece, and it was choreographed by Anna Sokolov, and in fact, it was Bernstein met Copland at an Anna Sokolov concert, so they're all tied together, and Tom is doing this on January 15th for Ellie's birthday at the community church.
I'm glad we could mention it, but we don't have a lot of time, and we have one more piece, and this is... the last movement of Elie Siegmeister's Cantata, I Have a Dream?
That's right.
And this is, who's in this? William Warfield?
Yes.
And Ronald Edwards of the tenor? Mm-hmm. You're the conductor of the Metropolitan Philharmonic Chorus.
This was at Harlem School of the Arts. Uh-huh. This was actually only the second performance of the Metropolitan Philharmonic Chorus. We're up to 47th through 50th, the next four will be. But this was... on Ellie's 80th birthday, which was Dr. King's 60th birthday, the same day, we did it at the Harlem School of the Arts, and it was broadcast on WQXR and on WBAI. Mm. So we're going to have the last movement, which is a lyric actually by Edward Mabley, "The Sound of Freedom," and it ends with. Instead, this was commissioned by a synagogue, but instead of saying, "The Lord our God, the Lord is one," it ends with, "All mankind are one."
Mm. It's a pity you weren't performing with Leonard at the time. You could have done the tenor part.
We're doing it now.
He joined in 2003 when he heard us on this station, and ever since then he's been doing all the projects. And he's one of the great supporters of the chorus.
Well, let's listen to the Sound of Freedom. Words of Martin Luther King, Jr., put to music by Elie Siegmeister, performed by William Warfield, Ronald Edwards, Leonard Lerman, the conductor of the Metropolitan Philharmonic Chorus, and performed at the Harlem School of Arts on January 15, 1989. Does that get performed much?
Oh. No, Elie's music, as I said, we had 60 concerts his 80th birthday year and 30 his centennial and now 110th. We're doing the only ones that I know of. We're doing four. And we're doing them on January 13th at 4 o'clock at the Puffin Cultural Forum in Teaneck and January 15th at 2:30 p.m. That's Tuesday. That's the actual birthday at the gallery of the Community Church, 40 East 35th Street. Actually, the gallery is 28 East 35th Street. And then the following Sunday, the 20th, at 2:30 p.m. at 40 East 35th Street, which is the Hall of Worship. And then one more performance on Long Island on Saturday, January 26th at 2:30 p.m. at the Long Beach Public Library. So we'll be doing that, the last three movements of I Have a Dream, at three of those concerts. And on the 15th, Tom will be singing Strangely Norm Braddock, and we'll have a number of other pieces.
These are the concerts that have been called Works of Social Consciousness,
right.
2019. Since we've been talking about social consciousness, this seems really appropriate. So the soloists will include Helene Williams and Thomas Smith.
That's right.
And a number of the pieces that we have been discussing here?
Well, the opera, A Love Letter from Rosa Luxemburg, which Helene is working on right now, will have music from two of the pieces that we did, Conscience and the Masha Kaliko love song. There'll also be work of Mark Blitzstein, which has never been heard before, children's cantata, Workers, Kids of the World Unite, that he wrote for the coming of Hans Eisler, but it was never performed. They never had a chorus that was able to do it, and we're doing it now for the first
time. So it was Bertolt Brecht and Hans Eisler.
That's
the Roundheads and
The Pointed Heads. We're doing that in the six-person version with chorus. Which is a parable about racism and the coming of Nazism and fascism. What could be more appropriate? The chorus was listening to it the other day and saying, wow, was this written yesterday? Nope, 1934.
That's why they say some music is timeless.
Yes, or political cycles come around, you know. The Cradle of Rock is done every time there's a crisis.
So these things will be performed either for a nominal fee or for free in Teaneck, and then, as you said, the Community Church of New York Gallery at 40 East 35th Street on the 15th of January.
And the 20th,
The 20th, again there, and then the 26th at 111 West Park Avenue, Long Beach, Long Island.
That's right.
And my great thanks to all of you for having been on our show.
It's great being part of it, Leonard. Thank you.
Leonard Lerman, Michelle Williams, and
Helene Williams.
Helene, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Not a bad comparison. And that does bring us to the end of our show. My great thanks to Leonard Lerman, Helene Williams, and Thomas Smith, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my producer, Jesse Lent, who helps make things run smoothly. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.